It's On Health. I'm Allison Aubrey. Our theme for this show is chewing, really. If you think about it, lots of things begin in the mouth. Disease, bacteria, digestion. We'll hear about a Victorian-era health fanatic named Horace Fletcher. He popularized the art of masticating or chewing a lot. But first, xylitol. Ring a bell? It's a natural sugar that helps prevent cavities, and it's fairly new to the scene here in the U.S. Just a few chewing gums are made with it. But in my research, I learned that in Finland, men, women, and children have been chewing xylitol for decades. Lots of it. A trip to Finland was out of the question this week, so we phoned up the Finnish embassy here in D.C., and they invited us over. Arriving a little after lunchtime, we didn't hear any gum smacking or bubble blowing, but staffer Jenny Arventaus assured us that there's lots of quiet chewing here, especially after meals.
When I moved here about 4 years ago, I went to the grocery store trying to find xylitol products, and I was shocked to see that most of the gums were more kind of like candy. And also I've seen it from American parents that they don't really want to buy gum for their children because it's considered a candy and it's not good for your teeth. And I'm used to the mentality that gum is actually the best thing for your teeth.
Jenny wanted us to meet the health liaison here at the embassy. Her name is Saya Normanen. And when we walked into her office, she was joined by her 4-year-old daughter, Pepe.
As you may know, that the xylitol was found in 1890 by French and German scientists. The significance for dental care was, or dental health, was discovered in Finland in 1970s. And the first xylitol gum came in 1975, and I was born at that year, so it's sort of been there my whole life. And curiously enough, the first gum was named as Yankee, which means in English Yankee. And I think that that's because chewing gum was associated with sort of American lifestyle. So the classical Finnish xylitol gum is called Pure Jenkki, which means bite Yankee.
And of course here we do obnoxious things with our gum, like blow bubbles and make loud clicking noises. As I've understood it, the Finns are much more discreet about the way you chew gum.
Yeah, the gum, the gum bites are much smaller. That's only the only product that I import from Finland here to US. So when I have family or friends visiting, we always ask that please bring some xylitol, because I have a 3-year-old daughter named Peppi who eats xylitol gum every morning. And that's called morning gum, so that she thinks that the thing is morning gum. It's so established, the concept, that she doesn't make any difference between gum. For her, it's morning gum.
Does this look like your morning gum?
Yeah.
Do you want to try it? So you know exactly what to do with this. She took this right out of my hand. That's our version. It didn't come from Finland, from your home country. This is American Tridents. But does it taste the same?
Does it taste as good as Moomin gum?
Yeah.
You know, it may seem a little counterintuitive that a sugar helps fight cavities. To help us understand how xylitol works, we called Peter Milgram. He's a professor in the Department of Dental Public Health Sciences at the University of Washington in Seattle.
Xylitol is actually a naturally occurring sugar made by our own bodies, and it's also present in fruits and vegetables.
So this is a synthesized form of it?
Right. It's in the United States, it's primarily made from corn waste. In Finland, where the original work on xylitol was done, it's made from birch bark.
Hmm. And it really does have an antibacterial agent. I mean, when people think of sugar, that is the agent they think of as rotting the teeth. So here we have a natural sugar that doesn't?
Yeah, but actually, I mean, it's very interesting. If you take pure sugar, pure table sugar, sucrose, nothing will grow in it. It doesn't support the growth of bacteria.
Right.
It's dilute solutions of sugar that support the growth of bacteria.
So why sugary foods lead to decay.
Right, exactly. But this particular sugar, xylitol, sorbitol, maltitol, none of them cause tooth decay.
And we've known this for a while, hey?
Long time. Yeah, long time.
So it's in the gums. I know that as a mom, when I go to pick up, when my kids beg for gum and I see that there's gum that says, you know, this will clean your mouth, I'm always very skeptical. But there must be something to those claims. They're sort of, they have the backed by the ADA seal to it. And I've sort of wondered about that.
This not only doesn't cause tooth decay, it helps prevent tooth decay.
And how does it do that?
It messes up the bacteria. What happens is that when you put this in the diet, the bacteria that cause tooth decay try to use it to make energy. So the analogy is the power plant. Okay, in the power plant, you put oil into the power plant, and the power plant produces energy from the oil, and it produces carbon dioxide and water. Now, what happens with sucrose? It's just like the power plant. The bacteria take in the sugar. They use it to make energy because that's what a bacteria needs to do in order to survive. And the byproducts of that are water and carbon dioxide, and that water is very acidic. It's lactic acid. So what happens when the bacteria takes in xylitol is that the bacteria is not able to actually use the xylitol to make energy. So they either die, or they find some other food source.
I see. So that's how it's an antibacterial, because it's not feeding the bacteria.
Exactly. And there are some bacteria that can tolerate xylitol. They can be in an environment that has xylitol in it and not die. But they have trouble sticking to the teeth.
So the bacteria comes off the teeth, ergo fewer cavities.
That's right.
Do you chew gum with xylitol in it?
I don't have any cavities.
Wow.
I never have.
Never?
Never, no.
Peter Milgram is a dentist and professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Washington. By the way, Peter Milgram says if you want to benefit from xylitol gum, you've got to chew about 6 grams of it. That means 2 pieces 3 times a day to have an effect. Now, on to the art of chewing. Have you ever heard that you're supposed to chew each bite 32 times? Well, our producer, Jessica Goldstein, recently attended an event where there was lots of eating and lots of chewing.
I'm sitting here at a table with Karen Lord and Mary Kay Ricks. Do you think about how much you chew when you're eating?
I think I do it, you know, unconsciously. I think I do what's adequate. I'm not a Nancy Reagan. I don't chew 30 times before I swallow.
When I was growing up, my mother taught me when you're eating corn, you have to chew it 100 times. Now, why was that? It's supposed to be hard to digest. None of us ever did it.
It was only corn. It was nothing else.
Nothing else but corn.
Hey, Andy, I hear that you tell your lovely wife, Hannah, that she needs to chew more.
Unfortunately, that it is true. Well, I had read years ago that it's an important thing for health to like chew the food a lot, and you know, there's like a Chinese saying that you should drink your food and chew your water.
No one did more to popularize this idea that we should all be chewing a lot than a man named Horace Fletcher. He was known as the Great Masticator. He believed that proper chewing was directly related to health and fitness. To find out more about his life and his ideas, we spoke to Dr. Arden Kristen. He's a professor emeritus of oral biology at Indiana University School of Dentistry. We reached him at his home in Indianapolis. Hi, Dr. Kristen.
Yes.
So it sounds like you've spent a good bit of time understanding the life of Horace Fletcher. Why don't you tell us a little bit about him?
Well, Horace Fletcher was a millionaire businessman and painter and speaker and pretty much a self-taught nutritionist. And he came up with the idea when he was about 40 years old that he had to get insurance policy. By that time, he was already a millionaire and had made his money in novelties and toys and silk from Japan. And so at that particular time, he applied for an insurance policy, but he was flabby and overweight and got turned down. So then he decided he probably was out of shape, maybe because he wasn't eating right. And so he started investigating about good nutrition.
And it seems like he started to focus in on the idea of chewing pretty early. He's best known for saying nature will castigate those who don't masticate.
That's correct.
And does this make good sense? What do we know about the value of chewing a lot?
Well, I think it makes pretty good sense because we know that digestion starts in the mouth. I mean, anybody who has studied anatomy and physiology knows there are enzymes in our saliva. We don't like to think about things like this. But we're supposed to, in masticating our food, that's the first step of nutrition and absorption of food in our body.
It seems as if he was trying to convince people that someone could transform themselves from a glutton into sort of a intelligent foodie just by slowing down.
Well, that's really what happened to him in his early 40s, because then he decided, once he discovered that he wasn't chewing his food properly, one of the first things that happened to him is he lost a whole bunch of weight. You know, if you spend all your time chewing, because, you know, Horace Fletcher later on came along and said, well, you should chew your food 50 to 100 times. But if you did that and you were spending all your time chewing, then you're not submitting your body to a whole bunch more food. And that certainly makes sense.
I'm curious to know, how did he promote these theories? I mean, in a way, I guess people would have a lot of reason to be suspect of him. He wasn't a dentist. He wasn't a doctor. He was somebody who sort of was a businessman. How did he get people to pay attention to him?
Well, it was interesting. What he did is he found a number of influential people around that he convinced. For example, he had some real advocates really fervent followers of him. For example, Thomas Edison, John Rockefeller, Upton Sinclair, the famous psychologist Henry James, J.C. Penney, Montgomery Ward.
A lot of titans of industry, huh?
These were all the titans, the famous people, and of course they exerted an enormous influence in their own sphere.
And of course people then went on to call chewing a lot Fletcherizing, is that right?
Yeah, that was the title. In fact, you can still look in some dictionaries and you'll see Fletcherism in there, and it was actually a term which was coined by Dr. John Harvey Kellogg of Battle Creek, Michigan. You know, the cereal magnet?
Mm-hmm.
At one time, Kellogg claimed that there were 200,000 families in the United States that lived by his precepts, and Kellogg was the one that really helped promote him a lot. So he had a lot of people behind him.
Is there any evidence that these more famous names, as you mentioned, John Rockefeller, Henry James, Upton Sinclair, any evidence that these folks really took his message to heart, that they were really chewing 100 times per minute or slowing down the pace?
Oh, yes. William James, you know, the very famous psychologist about the turn of the century. And he really decided he was going to Fletcherize his food. But finally, he wore out, and he complained, it nearly killed me to do this.
Have you ever tried this yourself?
Yes, I have, and very few of us are able to do this, because, you see, his principle was you chewed your food until it was a liquid. And then he says his big statement was, if you eat properly, food will swallow itself.
You know, I'm looking at a photo of Horace Fletcher at the moment, and he looks like a rather macabre man. And from what you've told me so far, it sounds like he had to have a lot of chutzpah, perhaps sort of an entrepreneurial spirit to have these ideas
absolutely.
Catch on. Was he a charming man? What's said about the kind of person he was?
He was very self-confident. He dressed in white.
In white?
Yes, he dressed in white, white shoes. He was just one of these kind of people that had a presence. He was a complex person, but when he believed in something, he flat out believed in it. And after World War I, when people were having problem getting food, he went over to Belgium and taught them how to chew their food. He says, you're not going to get much food, so to get the maximum benefit from the food you're going to get, we're going to Fletcherize your food.
Did that go over pretty well, I would imagine?
It was claimed that it helped save who knows how many millions of dollars worth of food, because people were getting full value received, I guess you could say, from the swallowing.
So getting more from less.
And getting more from less.
Let me ask you this. It seems unlikely that we'd be chewing 100 times per minute, but this idea, as you say, that slowing down may be good for digestion and good for weight overall, mm-hmm. do you think there's any kind of Fletcherizing light or some kind of halfway medium between our gulp and go culture and Fletcherizing?
Well, I do think, you know, his basic message was probably a pretty good message. Pay attention to your digestion, and I think we can learn. You know, someone has said something very wise that I found his quote recently. He says, if you want to learn something new, read an old book. So if you go back and you read his writing, I read his book on Fletcherizing, a lot of good sound stuff in there, you know, of just good ways to live.
Do you mind reading the poem that you have in front of you, something Horace Fletcher wrote?
One of the things that he liked was writing for Ladies' Home Journal. And in 1914, he had this little poem, which I thought was really quite interesting, and I'm sure has a lot of value to it. Don't gobble your food, but Fletcherize. Each morsel you eat, if you be wise. Don't cause your blood pressure ever to rise by prizing the menu by its size.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
That's quite all right.
Dr. Arden Kristen is Professor Emeritus at the Indiana University School of Dentistry. Well, we really like that idea that if you want to look for new ideas, go to an old book. So we'll be doing just that, reaching into the past to explore the new value of old ideas. If you have some old health rule of thumb or something your mother or grandmother told you, let us know. Write to us at nprhealth@npr.org. Have a great week. I'm Alice Halliburton.
Chew, 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 chew your bubble gum. Chew, 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 chew your bubble gum. Chew, 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 chew your bubble gum. Chew, 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 baby. Chew, 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 chew your bubble gum. Chew, 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 chew your bubble gum. Chew, 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 chew your bubble gum. Chew, 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 baby. First you pop, then you stop. The gum gets big and round. Blow your troubles away like bubbles when you hear that funny little sound. Chew, 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 chew your bubble gum. Chew, 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 chew your bubble gum. Chew, 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 chew your bubble gum. Chew, 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 chew your bubble gum.
Listen, sis, you're having fun chewing on your bubble gum. Give us some and we shall see just what fills your heart with glee.
Boys, you're right, I'm having fun chewing on my bubble gum. Bubble gum, it makes me sing. Here, chew some, twill make you swing. When you hear that funny little sound, choo 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 your bubble gum, choo 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 your bubble gum, choo 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 your bubble gum, choo.